revolution as the pod systems rattle from is, to my mind, the perfect summary of what revolutions are about. Why would revolutions be the pod? Revolution is the pod. Why would revolutions be like pods? Will revolution be like the pod?
Many people involved, maybe, huh? They're all agitating.
To get to the peas, you have to rip away the pod.
Okay.
And the pod might be the established system, and they went back. To change it, you have to rip away the pod.
What is it that the systems stand for that rattle into that, into the pan?
Information.
Present bureaucracy.
Okay, let's just expand bureaucracy a little and say governmental systems.
Our government.
Governmental systems, okay? So now we're getting an idea.
Social systems.
Social systems, which in turn relate to governmental systems. Let's just turn it around so you can see it. Okay, so.
One's radical change.
Right. What else?
Revolution is a radical change.
Right. Uh-huh. And what else about the pot, about the peas rattling into the pan? What characteristic does it have with respect to the what happens to those peas?
Agitation.
Agitation is the rattle. They rattle. And how about how they
watch out now? Somebody may eat up all those peas up and that'll be the end of the revolution.
By the time we... Okay, so you can't predict, can you? You can't predict. So, the order in which those peas land in the pan as they rattle out of the pod...
is totally unpredictable.
...is totally unpredictable. It is random. It is random, right? So that you have a revolution thinking that what you want is change. Assuming that the change, of course, will be for the better. Mm-hmm. That's why you have a revolution. Right? You don't like the present system. And you think what you're going to get, usually you have some idea that what you'll get will be X, Y, and Z, or A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. But does that usually happen in history?
No.
That a revolution results in something which is predictable? Au contraire. Au contraire. Let's see if we've got I've got another chair over here, and we've got one up here. Come on in, and I think there we go. I think we got enough here. We're just wrestling out this first lovely phrase of Emily Dickinson's, which is the first two words of the poem. The poem's a good poem. The first two lines are those which attract me, and indeed, one. College that I worked at, there was a course which we taught on revolutions. And I said to the person who taught the revolutions course that we were going to replace his course by simply having the students come into the classroom and put this up on the board and try to figure out what it meant with all its ramifications and replace the course with these six words, these seven words, right? So, we've got the randomness of the systems, we've got the noisiness of the process, a revolution is not a quiet process, and we've got the whole concept of revolution being for change, and the problem with revolutions being summarized in this brilliant seven-word, two lines, to the effect that you never can predict what's going to happen, and that indeed it may be worse than what you expected. We in America are liable to forget that because we are almost unique in the history of the Western world in that our revolution resulted in essentially what we wanted. It's extraordinary, just as it's extraordinary for a basically colonial nation to arise from a revolution against the mother country. Think of that as a norm, because that's what happened to us. But we were A, very lucky, and B, very skillful and persistent on the part of George Washington and his colleagues. They were very lucky, and they were very, very skillful. And they had a patsy for an opponent, essentially, militarily, certainly. And not terribly determined, not nearly as determined as England subsequently became, Britain subsequently became, with respect to other colonies, such as Ireland or India. It took a long time before they were willing to respond to the agitation because of the lesson they learned from us. But we were extraordinary, and revolution as the pod systems rattle from reflects more basically and accurately, historically, what happens with revolutions. She summarized it all. You may get something worse, right? In Russia, they had a revolution against, among other things, just to summarize it in the Dickinsonian fashion, they summarized it and no longer had to worship Christ. So they ended up having to worship Stalin. That's kind of the worst example, and that's a capsule summary of that revolution. So during Stalin's years, they had to worship a devil. Devil, one of the worst men ever, instead of continuing to be Christians. Well, that's one I put on the board, and I almost never get to give this explanation because I put it up there and let them think about it. This one is simply something that she wrote that I think is a lovely description of how people reacted to her poetry. All men say what to me? Get your picture, everybody in Amherst, Massachusetts, who receives a note from Emily Dickinson saying, what? All these little poems. Such as the one that I want to start out with. Tonight we're talking about immortality. And one of the things that occurred to me as I was thinking about her attitude toward immortality is to say that she felt that words were immortal. Words to her were of consummate importance. People who love words, and I'm one, think we have a kind of passionate love affair with words. But our love affair with words is nothing compared to hers. Words to her were meat and drink. Words to her were life. And words themselves had a vitality, a being, a growth, immortality. And she wrote, a word is dead when it is said, some say. I say, a word just begins to live that day. So it lives and then it grows and it continues to grow as I read it and share it with you, and if the educational process that we are engaged in here goes as it ought to go, then you'll share it with somebody else, and the, to shift the metaphor, the pebble that I have tossed into the pond and the circles which radiate out from that never stop, right? And that's from the word that she says, not the word in the terms that, that we're often discussing here at Holden, respecting the word of God. No, just the word. She thought that all words had a kind of sacredness. And she almost might say she worshipped words. Words were to her the most important thing. And she had a hand in creating words. Creating words. That's what a good poet does. A poet creates words. And I don't know, is anybody here involved in the profession of advertising? Good. Then I can say the rest of then I can say the rest of my maxim, right? Poets create words. Advertising kills words. By repeating them and repeating them and repeating them and repeating them to the point where you are so tired of them that you can't stand the word anymore, and the word which might have had vitality previously now is a husk. With all the meat and the meaning and the vibrancy of the words stripped out or dried up by that constant repetition. So, we're talking about immortality. Emily Dickinson had a way of dealing with death on the one side and immortality on the other, that is, as two things in many of her poems. But in lots of her poems, there tends to be a dual concern, one with death and the other with immortality. We'll share some of them that are primarily related to one and some of them that are primarily related to the others. To start off, why don't we have a look at one which I have in this handout, which some of you have. I've got a couple more here that I would be glad to pass out to folks to share. Somebody who doesn't have any. Some of you have had these before, and you want to try them here? And if you can look on, it's not essential to look on at all. Indeed, as I mentioned last evening, as I like to repeat, it's useful to get the poems through the ear. It's also useful to have the experience of sharing, of doing it two ways, with the eye and the ear. The ear is what the poet likes to have you share. This one is on page 9. At the top of the page, a small poem, which the last line of which we wrestled with a little last night. She's referring here to two important losses in her life, to the death of two close people to her. For our purposes, it doesn't matter so much who they are. And she wrote about that experience. My life closed twice before its close. It yet remains to see if immortality unveil a third event to me. So huge, so hopeless to conceive, as these that twice befell, parting is all we know of heaven, and all we need of hell. Maybe her most famous two lines at the end. So she deals with death and loss and immortality, constantly interweaving series of themes through a great deal of her poetry. Let's look at page 9 in the handout. We're on page 9, the second poem on page 9. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset from the king, be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly, with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me, and then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see. What do you think about the use of a fly?
Pretty appropriate around here.
Yeah. What do you think the fly stands for here? Why does she choose a fly to be such a central part of this poem, which sets itself up as being something quite different? In other words, it sets itself up as being an epoch-making event, the death of, obviously, somebody very close, a family member probably, because one is surrounded, the person who's writing the poem is surrounded by people who are probably family members, perhaps a close friend or two. So it is a terribly significant, indeed ceremonial event. But why then does she mention a fly? Shall I try one more time? For those of you who don't have it, sometimes it's useful to hear the poem twice. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be signable, and then it was there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me, and then the window failed, and then I could not see to see. What is the king that they're waiting for?
God.
God or what else?
Death.
So God similarly will come to call back, perhaps, to use the metaphor.
Why does she say when I?
Yeah.
When I died.
When I died. When I died. Mm-hmm. She's talking about when I died.
Her?
Good question.
I know she's talking about somebody else, but she's did she feel like she was dying with him, or did something in her die? Is that what she's saying?
Through a kind of leap of the imagination, she can constantly put herself in the first person in almost any other person's shoes. And in this case, it seems to me, don't you agree, that she's putting herself in the shoes of somebody who has indeed recently died. So it's a leap of imagination, but it is very personal. Yes?
Is it just a transition from life into death? That buzzing that she's...
Yeah?
Made this trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Is she saying that, you know, everybody, the sadness, sorrow, and then you look up and there's that doggone fly buzzing.
Mm-hmm.
Life must go on, you know, every little annoyance of a living, everything, you have to swat that fly and listen to it buzz around you.
Uh-huh.
In other words, everything goes on as usual despite this death of the law.
Fly's going to go on living. Right.
Could the fly represent life?
Life at its most, what?
Annoying.
Annoying.
Yeah.
Bothersome,
nettlesome, vexing.
Yeah.
Life at its most mundane. At its most
right.
homely.
Yeah. Right.
At its
yeah.
most
yeah.
earthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Goes on, even though this great event. How about, don't you think that she had something in mind respecting contrast here? What are the contrasts that she might be playing with here?
Smallness of the fly.
Vis-a-vis what else?
To the king and the king stays.
King.
Precious thing.
In vast things, the vastest of all, of which is God.
With an insect, with a contrast.
Yeah, how contrasting can you get from a buzzing of a fly, which is, to a housewife especially,
mm-hmm.
a hateful thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's hateful. A blowfly, as they used to call it. We don't call it a blowfly anymore much. But it is a hateful thing, particularly to a housewife who knows and who cares about cleanliness. And often she had that in mind, because that's what she did as a person daily. So often you put yourself into the shoes of a person who's responsible for a household, and a fly is anathema. Because a fly, not just because it's buzzing around, because you know that it's dirty.
That's persistence.
And it's persistence, yes. And that's
shut it away, and there it's
gone. Comes back, right? It keeps coming back. So we've got that contrast. So maybe we even have here, if we consider this scene as set up to be, as it was, a scene that would be typical in a 19th century family home when death was imminent. This is just what they did. You went into the house of your relative, and you sat in the room, and you waited for the event to transpire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was an opportunity to observe that momentous transition. And it was frequently an occasion of great warmth and great comfort, and it was kind of a revelation on some occasions. And indeed, it would seem to me that this is what the family expected. And what she expected as well. She had probably done this, the person was dying now, in the case of other relatives. And it had been, as it was with Annie and her mother, as she shared last night in another forum, it was a very warm and meaningful occasion, and it was a kind of ceremony, and it seemed appropriate. Particularly if we have in mind that indeed that is a moment when God will appear. He will come and take. He will come and receive, if you prefer, that individual who is moving from one status to another, a transition from this world to the next world. Why would you absent yourself from such an occasion? However, in this case, what she expected, some great, momentous, huge event happens is she's watching it, and then her eyes glaze, and she cannot see. So there's got to be some irony here. Think, let's say that there's some irony here. She was not at all above it in this kind of portentous occasion to see the irony of it. That here I am giving you this grand lecture, imparting this erudition to you, and what is buzzing around her head? Irony, right? It's irony that I, the dignified professor, share it. Get out of here! The contrast, right? It's irony that she's after. So this is one tree that she handles.
Could it be something else other really than a fly? Could it be something that comes in, keeps coming into her mind, that buzzes through her mind, that is as unwelcome as a fly?
Like what?
Well, this is a, as we say, solemn, momentous occasion, and something completely unrelated keeps back into her mind.
Something that she left undone.
Yes,
for example,
she left
perhaps.
Undone. Toward the person that she's
arguing. I heard a forum once on the part of people who tend to die, hospice people and others. And one of the things that they said was, particularly with women, but with men as well, what seems to concern people more than anything else on this occasion is how they look. How they look, isn't that amazing? Is my hair? All right. This is an occasion that's of importance to me. It's like going to church. You want to be just a little more dressed up, a little more presentable. You're going to put your best face foot forward. You're going into the presence of God in your church. Also going into the presence of your neighbors, your critical-minded neighbors, who may have a rather critical little side to them as they see whether you're wearing the same old dress that you wore two springs ago or three springs ago on this first day of spring, on this Easter Sunday. I said to some of you weren't present, so I'm going to share it again. I love a little poem that she had about that week, which is as follows. The show is not the show, but they that go. Menagerie to me, my neighbor be. Fair play, both came to see. One more time. The show is not the show, but they that go. Menagerie to me, my neighbor be. Fair play, both came to see. I shouldn't wonder that as you came in here this evening, and I wasn't observing particularly because I didn't plan to use this poem, although when I am going to use it, I always have to just kind of like have a look, and I just watch as people come in. I'm sure she's wearing blue jeans. She's wearing these shoes. This is a formal occasion. I just got my old shoes. Well, that same old sweater. Well, I guess she likes it. Well, I guess he just hasn't got any other jackets. It always a little of that, huh? Maybe it's innocent, but it's human. It's very, very human. So, the show is not the show. It's not. We didn't come here to hear me lecture you about Emily Dickens. You came here to see what the other guys were. Well, she looks a little peaked, doesn't she? I think she's really over her illness, but I'm not so sure. The show is not the show. And then you see your second metaphor is.
He's a bear.
Oh, she's a little mouse thing. A little mouse. Darting around. menagerie to me, my neighbor bee. I've got an animal or a bird in mind for every one of them. Huh? Fair play. Both came to see. They're looking at me in that same way. Those tennis shoes to give a lecture. They're looking at you and saying, why is she wearing such good shoes? What does she think this is? A lot of that goes on, right? She encapsulates it, huh? The show is not the show, but they the go. Menagerie to me, my neighbor bee. Fair play. Both came to see.
I've liked that poem for a long time, but I always interpreted that they came to see the play or whatever it was, but she came to see the people, because the people
Then the final line you see is, fair play, both came to see. They came to see me, and I came to see them, right? And after the church service is over, and they all go home, and they're having their lunch, or their late breakfast, or brunch, or whatever it is, and then she'll say to her husband, or he'll say to her, Marty, he really is a horse of a man. He's getting bigger, that boy. He's 6'5", getting bigger. He looks like a giraffe, doesn't he? That's what happens. See, and that's what she's getting at. Human foibles. Human foibles. So there may have been some of that taking place. So it might, I really like your thought about it. The fly might not be the fly. You always have to look for that in her. And sometimes you find things that, one of the reasons she's fun to teach is that I'm constantly having students say to me, the way you did, well, what about this? Might it not be that? And I say, of course, that's right on. It could be one of the things we're talking about, but also pretty obvious that she was thinking that. So instead of the fly, it could be maybe her conscience. Maybe she thinks she's a Catholic like me. She thinks, well, I forgot to confess. I have used profane language 3 times in the last week. I've got it done. Oh.
The poem you read for a night on success, which is a little more difficult. We were wondering if you would take this session and then have previously taped the session, how much difference there would be in the interpretation between two groups.
That's really what I was saying. There's so much creativity that's brought to bear that I often find different statements of a concept or quite fresh ones. I never thought of this, and I don't remember any student ever saying that. Maybe the fly is not the fly. Maybe the fly stands for whatever. Maybe it stands for something quite different. Maybe it stands for conscience. Maybe it stands for try this. Maybe it stands for doubt. The Lord, I believe now that I'm going to indeed, as everybody standing around is expecting, pass unto you. But in the back of my mind, since I was a girl of 6 years old, I thought, and you thought during those last days of illness, now that's way behind me. There's no doubt in my mind. And for heaven's sakes, at this moment, pardon the ejaculation, right? It's too apropos for words, but for heaven's sake. For heaven's sake, pass it for the moment. Maybe doubt springs in. Huh? I'm not sure this is really going to work. It's really going to work. And all these people waiting here, maybe the Lord's not going to come. Maybe it's just fly. And that's her last thought. And nobody knows. Nobody knows. She talked about being jealous. That the rest of the people in that room then, one of the things that they will feel after the event is jealousy. Jealousy? Yeah. Jealousy. Because we've spent our lives wanting to know. Absolutely, surely, not a moment of doubt, that Jesus will be there and that he will take us by the hand. But we know that's a metaphor. We know that's a metaphor. He's not going to have a hand. It's going to be something else. What is it going to be? Well, we study that. We think about it. We look at the Bible. We try to figure out. Now, she knows. And I still don't know. Jealous of her. She has a very good poem about jealousy and medication. Let's take a look at one that I don't have on my handout list. Here's one that I want to be very sure to get in, so I want to move to it right now. Here's one where she's talking about the event of death in quite different terms from the person in the 19th century room waiting for the great event to transpire. It's quite a different metaphor. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too, for his civility. We passed the school where children played at wrestling in a ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling in the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. Since then, 'tis centuries, but each feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were towards eternity. A strong poem. One more time? No, you have a different version. Well, separate question. Very fair question. She has the version that is, by the way, thank you for giving me the chance to make the plug, Betty. Oh, want to hold it up? This is Final Harvest, which is the best book, which is available in the bookstore. Plug. It's available in the bookstore, because I recommended to the bookstore that they get these talks, and several books have picked it up, including Betty. And that book has Thomas Johnson's interpretation of these poems, which I actually like somewhat better than the one that I have here for many poems, which is by Emily Dickinson's niece, whose married name was Bianchi. This, by the way, is the Final Harvest version that she has, that Betty has, but in an earlier edition, which is all marked up. This one's all marked up with my junk in it. This one's even more marked up. See what I've got around this poem? So I read this version because I rather like this version. I have some mixed feelings because I like some things about that one too. And there are various interpretations of her poetry because she often left several choices of words. So her editors had to figure out which one was best. So Bianchi was the first one. And this is what Bianchi decided would be best. Thomas Johnson came later and he decided what he thought would be the authoritative version, which is by and large accepted.
May we hear both versions?
Yeah.
Sure. I'll read this one. Why don't you read it? Annie, you want to read it? Or Betty, you want to read it? Annie, you read it. I'll read this version, and Annie will read the other version.
What is the last name there? Bianchi?
Bianchi, right. B-I-A-N-C-H-I. Martha Dickinson Bianchi. That was the niece. That was the daughter of her brother, Austin. Her dear brother Austin and his wife Susan. I'll read this one, then you read that one, all right? Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too, for his civility. We passed the school where children played at wrestling in a ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling in the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. Since then to centuries, but each feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too, for his civility. We passed the school where children strove at recess in the rain. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. Or rather, he passed us. The dews grew quivering and chill, for only gossamer, my gown, my tippet, only tulle. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice in the ground. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity.
So there's a slight difference, and there's one reference in that one which I rather like, and that is the reference to temperature, that it gets chill. It gets chill, and her light dress and her light scarf is not sufficient against the chill. So that's a nice addition. It's a tad more difficult to understand. Yes?
Something else in there. There was something about the roof. It sounded like
the cornice in the ground. This was the cornice but a mound. That's anybody's call, right? The cornice in the ground. Right. You're talking about a headstone. You're talking about a headstone, right? Right. What about this basic metaphor? What about the person who drives the carriage? What reaction do you have to him? Who is he?
Dead.
He is dead. What about, what else about him?
He was in no hurry.
He was in no hurry. He was in
stable.
No hurry. He's stable. He's stable. What else about him? He's a gentleman. He could be a good, solid, Amherst, Massachusetts gentleman. Right. Anything else about him? I think we've got the main things. Why does she not have the capacity to stop for him? Because I could not stop for death, he kind of stopped for me. Why couldn't she stop for him?
Too busy.
She's too busy. Exactly right. What's she doing? She's living. Now she's got a lot of things to do today, right? She's got a little list. You have a list every day? I have a list. I couldn't live without a list. To do. Okay. Pick up Annie at the theater. Stop for notebook, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Things I've got to do. Hey, I'm busy. Whether I'm busy or not.
You have to make an itinerary so we're not going clear back and forth.
Exactly. The order then is important. Right. So we're all orderly and busy. So she's too busy. Yeah. So being the gentleman that he is, he stops for her, and he's very much the gentleman. This is happening. He gets her in the carriage. But it's clear, it seems to me, that it's the last journey. It's clear to her. Does he deceive her about what's going on?
No.
Not a bit. He's quite straightforward. That's what's going to happen. But she's very aware of this important journey. She is taking in everything very clearly. She sees the kids playing at wrestling in the schoolyard. She sees the corn. She sees, or rather, here's a nice thing that any version has that mine didn't have as I read it. Or rather, it passes us.
Yeah. We passed the setting sun. Or rather, he passed us.
Or rather, he passed us. Because when you are deceased, you know, it's passing you. Mm-hmm. Particularly, you're so stationary, it's passing you. It's passing you. Any other comments or questions about this poem? I think it's a very evocative poem.
She still seems, she's watching everything, but it's sort of suddenly that she sees where the horses are going.
Yeah. She had suspicions. He wasn't deceiving of her, but she wasn't entirely clear about it. It just seemed like the final journey, but where was she actually going? In what direction were the horse's heads facing? Such a nice metaphor, because when one drove in horses, and if it had been in the carriage with the horse, it's the horse's head that tells you where you're going. You look at the horse's head and over the horse's head to see the road ahead. just as we look out the windshield on the novel. The horse's head is key. Okay, let's got time for maybe one more. This is a brief one. This is on page 294 of that Final Harvest book. 294. This might not seem to be about immortality, but maybe it is. A lot of ambiguity nowadays. How happy is the little stone that rambles in the road alone, and doesn't care about careers, and exigencies never fears, whose coat of elemental brown a passing universe put on, and independent as the sun, associates or glows alone, fulfilling absolute decree in casual simplicity. One more time. How happy is the little stone that rambles in the road alone and doesn't care about careers and exigencies never fears, whose coat of elemental brown the passing universe put on, and independent as the sun, associates or grows or glows alone, fulfilling absolute decree in casual simplicity. How could this be about immortality? How could it be about the human condition? How does this stone's experience differ from yours and mine?
Bronze is very complex.
The stone doesn't think.
Very simple, doesn't think.
Doesn't have many problems.
Doesn't have many problems, doesn't have much to worry about.
A stone is forever, but we aren't.
A stone is longer anyway than we are. Forever is a long time.
Yeah.
But it's longer. It's a lot longer than we are. How about the line fulfilling absolute decree? How does that relate to a theological concept that might have been something that a 19th century New Englander might have worried about more than we might?
The creation of
predestination.
In that the stone has no choice, absolute decree.
Absolute decree, right. Who among humans and in what faith might have absolute decree? Calvinists, right? Calvinists, the elected few who are chosen. Fulfilling. They would think, if you are lucky enough, A, to believe that concept, and B, to assume that you are one of the chosen. Most people who believe the concept indeed believe they are among the chosen. That's the way it seems to me. And that's the way it seems to Dickens, I think. Fulfilling absolute decree. She thinks that's nonsense for human beings. She thinks that's nonsense. I mentioned last night that she could not buy her ultimate iniquity, which is so much a part of the Puritan theology that her forebears believed in New England, and that her brother and sister and mother and father believed, and her Amherst townspeople. They believed that they were basically bad. I mean, really bad. And that it took the belief in Christ to bring them out of that awful, malefic status that they were in. So she wasn't able to accept that. Further, to lay on her the concept that you are not selected, you are not elected, you are not among those who is fully fulfilling absolute decree, Emily, which might have been stated to her by Calvinist New Englanders as well. That to her was a further inanity. Absurd for her. And this is, in a way, her statement of that concept. Who is it that fulfills absolute decree? that little stone, and not my Calvinist brethren in this town. The little stone may indeed be said to fulfill absolute decree, and therefore he is happy. My townspeople are happy, but it's based upon what is obviously nonsense. The little stone, on the other hand, I can see he's happy, right? He's not complaining. He's not fussing. Doesn't appear to be worrying about anything. Every man and woman I see down the street seems to be worried about something.
It's like, remember there used to be pet rocks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rocks. He's not a pet rock, right? Why do you have a pet rock? Well, because you need somebody you can count on. I want a rock. I want a friend who is?
Solid.
Like a rock. Huh? You are a rock.
Solid.
Sure, how this relates to Peter?
Right.
Peter, you are a rock, and upon this rock I will build my church. I don't know, I never thought of that. Huh? There's something there? Think about it. Maybe there's something there. Maybe there's something there.
You're taking up both the Catholics and the Calvinists in one column.
Oh, she takes them all on. She doesn't hesitate. She takes them all on. No hesitation about it. She was absolutely fearless. Absolutely fearless.
Well, I had a point when you mentioned the word rock. Our Lord wasn't talking to Peter the man, but rather Peter the confession. Because he had confessed, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And then our Lord says, "You are Peter," and the Greek word says, "the man." But upon this rock, which in the Greek means the shelf, this confession, I build my church.
Okay, thank you for that additional thought, which it seems to me is a lovely transition to the Vesper service. Go in peace.